Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Once and Future Sex, Going Medieval on Women's Roles in Society, by Eleanor Yonaga, read by Samara Naimi. Introduction. In late 14th century Prague, Archdeacon Pavel of Janovica embarked on a tour of the Grand Imperial City's parish churches to see if locals had any religious issues that they wanted addressed. In the parish of St. Andre the Greater, in the Old Town, the archdeacon was alerted to the presence of a certain woman called Domka. According to her fellow parishioners, Domka was living with, and even heading, a group of suspect women in the house of a man called Henry, even though she was married to one of the king's chamberlains. To make a living, the women were selling blessed herbs to customers who complained of head ailments. This arrangement was a suspect religious emergency for several reasons. First, Domka was living outside her husband's control, while the others didn't seem to be attached to any man at all other than their landlord. Second, while their herb business was technically licit, the fact that a bunch of women were participating in it made it seem to be pushing the bounds from standard herbal medicine into magical remedies. And third, a group of women living together like this meant that they must be running and working in an unlicensed brothel. The community concern about Domka and her roommates shows us that women in medieval Europe had it bad, but not in the way most of us think. We know they had a difficult time because our society was built by theirs. And women are still at a disadvantage with men. Today, women face, among other things, lower wages in return for the same work, a disproportionate workload at home, disbelief from medical professionals about our pain levels, an expectation that we will always look sexually attractive but engage in sex only with our correct and designated partners and in exactly the right amount, and sexual harassment and huge risks of sexual and physical assault while we go about our daily business. If we are still going through all this now, in the era of feminism, it stands to reason that medieval women had it worse, lacking the benefits of the pill, the Equal Rights Act, and Dolly Parton's 9-to-5. Yet we seldom take the time to learn how medieval women were considered and treated in their own time and why, instead assuming that they just faced a more draconian version of our same issues. This is somewhat true, as Domka and her pals were reported to the archdeacon, who had the power to excommunicate them from the church and have them driven from their homes. In this case, however, nothing seems to have happened at all. Were these women suspect and the subjects of communal monitoring and gossip? Yes. Was the church going to do anything about it? No. After all, these women seemed just to be doing what women naturally did. Suspicious stuff. There was no real way to stop that. When we ignore history like this, and assume that women have always been treated in one particular way that we are only now beginning to overcome, we accept that our society has always been this way, and indeed should be this way. Our world, as a collective, is simply responding to the natural deficiencies of women and is organizing itself to adjust for them. We tend to agree that our society is beginning to address such shortcomings now, yet we assume that women in the past were treated as we are treated, for the same reasons, just without the benefits of the modern world to help them make up for their own innate and natural deficiencies. The fatalism of such assumptions is rage-inducing. The idea that this is how things always were and that our societal expectations of women have developed as a result of some immutable truth about over half of the world's population is just too convenient. More to the point, it is also wrong and has no historical basis. Whatever problems we may have with women now, we don't generally agree that they are so sex-crazed and heretical that when left to their own devices, they will start a brothel with a nice little side racket in magical herbs. Clearly, some things have changed. If we want to understand how Western society got its current attitudes about women, we have to retrace its steps back to medieval Europe. Sadly, we often treat medieval European history as the ultimate in obscure or unnecessary knowledge. We use the term medieval as shorthand for backward or barbaric, as something that we've learned from, moved past, and bettered ourselves as a result of. We are so sure of what we would find if we took a look at medieval history that we often don't bother. But this attitude is not only incorrect, It is also one reason our society is not moving toward an equitable future. Medieval literally means middle time. It describes a span of about 1,100 years, from the fall of Western Rome in 476 to sometime in the 16th century, the interval between the ancient period and our modern period. In other words, it acts as a kind of bridge, explaining how modern society moved from the ancient world to its current state, or rather, it would if we paid attention to it. Because of the period's placement between two eras, studying its gender norms allows us to see where some of our ongoing assumptions about gender come from. Our consideration of women as naturally weak and inferior, and therefore requiring protection and guidance, is an ancient and medieval holdover. Understanding that allows us to interrogate why we still believe it. If we think medieval people are so backward, why do we agree with them about this? Moreover, studying medieval gender norms allows us to see that many assumptions about women have, in actuality, changed drastically since the medieval era. When we realize that gender expectations have massively shifted in a number of ways, but our worst and most parochial behaviors have not, we can reject them. The only unbroken tradition in terms of gender norms is treating women as inferior, and we can stop doing that at any time. Over the course of this book, we will examine the historical problem with our societal insistence that women are X, and we therefore respond to that with Y. In this book, we will focus first on the intellectual underpinnings of the medieval approach to women. The ancient writings of Plato, Aristotle, Galen, and Hippocrates shaped medieval society's philosophical approach to women and gender. Further, to understand the religious bedrock of medieval Europe, we will consider the church fathers, like Augustine and Jerome, whose works provided the framework for Christian theology. Armed with a good understanding of ancient thinkers, we can encounter their medieval counterparts. They will include theologians like Albertus Magnus, Aquinas, and Hildegard of Bingen, but also secular writers like Chaucer and Christine de Pizan, whose literary works reflect the views that their academic counterparts argued over. Once we have a solid grasp of whose ideas these were and how they were transmitted, we will move on to a consideration of beauty, that most important of feminine features. We will see that just as medieval people looked to the past to guide their understandings of knowledge, so too did they look back to learn how to identify which women were hot. Understanding the medieval checklist for attractive attributes helps to explain medieval women's beauty and fashion regimes and allows us to consider the work that they put into living up to the specific beauty standard. Even though they were told that there was exactly one way to be attractive, women were also instructed that they should under no circumstances attempt to live up to that expectation. Women were simply meant to be beautiful effortlessly. To attempt to meet the beauty standard was to face ridicule and even to gamble with their own soul. Medieval women were forced to walk a tightrope between living up to stringent criteria for public adoration and successful marriages, and what was deemed an unseemly interest in the beauty regimens that allowed for these things. Frustratingly, the beauty that women had to embody was often also condemned because it distracted men's minds from lofty civic and religious considerations to the most base and feminine of subjects. Sex. To better understand medieval attitudes toward sex, we have to understand the theological expectations that medieval people navigated. Yet most medieval Christians were happy to gamble with their souls here and there for a good time and put it upon women to trespass against the Holy Church's prohibitions on sex. Unlike in our day, women were conceptualized both as sex-addled and as insatiable in their demands, to the point that there was constant worry that women would be adulterous. They were even thought to turn to magic if their sexual demands were stymied. Overall, the medieval concept of women's sexuality looks almost nothing like ours, except that it was considered wrong. After we establish how women were meant to look and love, we will turn more broadly to the expectations of medieval women outside the bedroom. First and foremost, women were seen as wives and mothers. The church at times attempted to intervene and set them on a path to religious contemplation and celibacy. By and large, however, to be a woman meant to be viewed as breeding stock. While most women did marry and have children, they were also expected to be heavily involved in any number of occupations. The majority of medieval women were peasants, performing agricultural labor that ground on month after month and year after year, Outside farm work, peasant women, like their city counterparts, might be involved in cottage industries, like weaving, baking, or brewing beer. Some women worked in rarefied occupations as artists and artisans, as shopkeepers and traders, medical professionals, and when the church got its wish, as nuns. Still, wealthy women did not have lives of leisure. Being a noble or royal woman was in and of itself a form of specific and taxing work. So while women were first and foremost wives and mothers, they were never considered just that. To be a medieval woman was to be a worker, even if that work was not necessarily valued in the same way that men's labor was. Finally, we will move on to our own expectations in these same areas. We will see how the philosophical and academic justifications we've developed about women's nature are used to insist that our attitudes towards women have always been in place, but that we are also now living in a golden age for women. Knowing both the presumptions about medieval women and the reality of their lives, the current expectations we place on women will appear as anything but traditional. Our notions of the ideal woman have changed a great deal over time, as has our concept of what exactly is wrong with women. What has remained static, unfortunately, is our desire to subjugate women, to judge them by the harshest possible standards and find them wanting. The outcome is the same. It's just that the justification for reaching it has changed. This work is not, however, fatalistic. If our ideas about women are continuously remade to justify our poor treatment of women, they can be remade to respect women's abilities and desires. Once we understand that our biases about women are culturally constructed, we can deconstruct them and start again. So, in Chapter 1, let us begin the demolition at its base, the philosophical framework of the medieval understanding of women. Chapter 1. Back to Basics. In 1371, Geoffrey Chrétien de La Tour Landry began to write a book for his daughters. In its preface, he recorded his overwhelming love and devotion for their mother, who was practiced to all honor and to every excellence, and hers was courtly carriage and demeanor. Of the good, she was the best. Her death sent him into a decades-long depression over the loss of his perfect love, and at the same time, it made him aware of what he needed to do to bring up his daughters to follow in her footsteps. His soul's desire was that all honor and advantage might be theirs, for they were yet young and small, so that they would require to be early taken in hand and to be gently broken. So he decided he would make a book, wherein he would have collected the memorable instances of admirable women, so as to show, by their pattern, what was true feminacy and good conduct, and also how, by their virtues, they were held in honor and estimation, and will ever continue to be so. When he committed these words to parchment, Geoffrey not only gave his daughters a social and moral guide, he also provided a perfect example of his society's attitudes towards women. Every woman had the possibility of attaining the apogee of femininity, being a cherished wife and mother, with a devoted husband who would compose poetry for her and write of her fondly years after her death. However, women like this were not born but made, through the timely intervention of their male family members and with examples from the past. It was men who knew what women should be, and men who were best able to understand and tame the nature of women to be exactly that. For a beloved daughter to become a cherished wife, men must break her worst feminine attributes to tame her into a helpmeet, the ultimate status for any medieval woman. At least, that was the case if you asked medieval men, and sometimes even when you didn't. If ideal women could be made, it was also true that without targeted intervention, women were emphatically not that. The ideal default humans were men, while women were an afterthought, or mirror of them that was meant to work for and complement the dominant sex. They were also seen to lack the beneficial characteristics that men had. Where men were strong, constant, rational, and pious, women left to their own devices would end up weak, flighty, conceited, lustful, and worst of all, unmarried as a result. The arrival of a girl into the world was therefore not necessarily unwelcome, but meant that parents like Joffrey had their work cut out for them if they wanted their daughters to be functioning parts of the family and society. These ideas about women and their nature did not spring fully formed from the head of Zeus. They were derived from ancient scholars. The intellectuals of the time believed they were standing on the shoulders of giants, a phrase that was coined by the scholar and philosopher Bernard of Chartres, circa 12th century. What Bernard meant was that knowledge was cumulative, begun by the great philosophers and thinkers of the ancient world, and steadily built upon by later scholars. In fact, the entire medieval educational system was constructed around and upon the work of writers from ancient Greece and Rome. When it came to sex differences, the ideas of a core group had an outsized influence on medieval thought. Medieval intellectuals revered their forefathers as having had a philosophical system that was not only superior, but almost divine in nature, based on the very fact of their being ancient. That meant they were born closer in time to the existence of the Garden of Eden, where God had been present. Since then, as humanity retreated further and further from that time and place of divinity, it had steadily been losing knowledge. The creation myth, meanwhile, provided a fertile theological starting point for medieval philosophers and theologians. It was just one part of a sophisticated Christian theological framework, added to in the patristic era, which lasted from roughly AD 100 to 450, by the Church Fathers, on which medieval European scholars sought to expand. To understand how medieval people thought about women, first we have to understand where they got their ideas. This means looking back to the ancient past to see the giants whose shoulders the medieval people were standing on. Theorizing women's bodies, Hippocrates. The most ancient of the writers whom medieval thinkers revered was the Greek physician Hippocrates of Kos, circa 460 to 370 BCE. Even today, Hippocrates, as close to a household name as you can be when you're 2,500 years old, is hailed as the father of medicine. His name is forever attached to the Hippocratic Oath, which all doctors take as their main tenet, and which commands them to, among other things, abstain from all intentional wrongdoing and harm, apply for the benefit of the sick all measures that are required, and remember that they remain a member of society with special obligations to all their fellow human beings. Hippocrates founded a school for physicians and thus gave rise to an entire class of well-trained medical practitioners, all of whom stressed professionalism and careful observation of systems and techniques. Confusingly, because of this school and the number of people it trained, a lot of Hippocratic texts weren't necessarily written by this one man. Instead, it is a corpus of texts written by his acolytes and those trained using Hippocratic methods. You may wonder how people in medieval Europe could have been reading and writing about Hippocrates, since as an ancient Greek he was, well, reading and writing in ancient Greek. The answer is that they were reading him in translation, as generations of students had been doing for centuries. Hippocratic texts had long formed the backbone of medical training in the classical world. They were still taught in Alexandria when it became the center of learning for the Roman world. Romans, as you may well know, spoke Latin and were intent on translating important works into Latin in order to save themselves the trouble of learning ancient Greek. The Hippocratic texts thus entered Roman libraries in their common tongue. When the Western Roman Empire fell, Hippocrates' popularity did not fall with it. The Ostrogoths, the so-called barbarians who toppled the dying Western Roman Empire, copied the Alexandrian Hippocratic model for training their physicians in their new capital at Ravenna. In fact, the Ostrogoths liked Hippocrates so much that they went out of their way to translate texts that hadn't made the jump to Latin yet. These included works like Diseases of Women, which pretty much does what the title says, as well as his aphorisms, which had short, pithy statements to guide physicians, starting with, "Life is short, and art long, the crisis fleeting, experience perilous, and decision difficult. The physician must not only be prepared to do what is right for himself, but also to make the patient, the attendants, and externals cooperate." The Hippocratic school and its texts are absolutely critical to understanding classical and medieval medical thought. But although its system was based on observation, we would not call what they practiced medicine or science today. As a case in point, one of the absolute cornerstones of Hippocratic thought was something called humoral theory, or humorism. The idea behind humorism was that humors existed as four liquids in every human body: blood, phlegm, yellow bile, and black bile. These humors were associated with the four elements: air, water, fire, and earth, respectively. There were also four temperaments associated with the humors: sanguine, phlegmatic, choleric, and melancholic. While all human bodies contained all four humors, humorism taught that they existed in varying quantities within the bodies of men and women. Men were seen as hot and dry, or naturally sanguine and socially useful. Women, in contrast, were cold and wet, therefore more likely to be phlegmatic or placid. Having said that, the fact that all humans had all four humors meant that people's humoral balance allowed some wiggle room for how they behaved. The historian Sheri Syed Gedelrab has characterized these differences as a sliding scale between the sexes, meaning that Hippocrates and his acolytes accepted the possibility that a person could be more masculine or feminine than others in his or her own sex. A person's humoral balance also changed over their lifespan, a process depicted much like the passage of seasons through the year. Young people were considered drier and warmer, and older people colder and wetter. These were not merely descriptions or observations. They served as a system for how the humors should interact with each other. Women should be cold and wet and behave in a particular way, but you might meet some who were hotter and drier than the average. There could be feminine men and masculine women. The temperament of various sexes could change because of certain activities. By certain activities, of course, I mean sex. In his treatise on generation, for example, Hippocrates announced that women should have intercourse with men because their health is better than if they do not. Intercourse, by heating the blood and rendering it more fluid, gives an easier passage to the menses, whereas if the menses do not flow, women's bodies are prone to sickness. This is instructive in several ways. It tells us that the Hippocratic concept of women's bodies was that they were A, strange, and B, prone to failure, specifically because they have uteruses. This makes sense from the standpoint of a physician who's attempting to explain to other physicians how bodies work. The thing about women, as opposed to men, was that they had all this stuff that men did not, and it was inside them where it was difficult to observe. As a result, Hippocratic scholars' concern figured primarily on the unruly and unknowable uterus and what it was up to inside the secretive female body. For them, the uterus was an independent entity inside women. As a result, it could wander around and cause medical problems that men didn't have, including a condition known as hysteria, which caused a sense of suffocation, trembling, anxiety, and, in extreme cases, convulsions and paralysis. One surefire way to alleviate hysteria was to become pregnant. During pregnancy, the womb couldn't wander, as it was pinned in one place while the fetus was growing. If a post-pubescent woman was not currently pregnant and ideally was married, she should have sex regularly in order to keep the uterus well moistened and warm. Otherwise, without sex, the uterus might not bleed on time, or it might move toward the other wetter organs in the body, the brain or heart or liver, in order to absorb their moisture. A woman with her womb on her brain could act irrationally, making life difficult for everyone around her. Undersexed women were therefore a matter of public concern. In the Hippocratic world, and therefore in the medieval world, a liver was a liver and a brain was a brain, but women had an extra weird thing that made them incomparable to men. Women were physically more complicated, and their complication was mysterious and unknowable by virtue of it being inside them. This prevented much medical study, because anatomical dissection was essentially unheard of in ancient Greece. This was because corpses were seen as a potential pollutant, especially if the skin was cut, and because legal and religious prohibitions upheld the sanctity of the dead. All in all, then, women's internal anatomy stayed a secret over this period. Spiritually philosophizing women.
Plato.
Physicians weren't the only ancient thinkers to hold forth on sex. The philosopher Plato had a lot to say on the subject as well. What Plato thought about women was particularly influential because, much like Hippocrates before him, he didn't philosophize in a vacuum. He started a school and thereby guaranteed his own legacy. Plato's was outside Athens, and it was called the Academy. At the Academy, Plato inaugurated whole branches of thought and began the European tradition of dialectic and dialogue. He also thought about sex. In the ancient world, it is fair to say, Plato's writing was as big a deal for philosophers as Hippocrates was for physicians. And his dialogue Timaeus was an equally big influence on medieval thinkers. The Timaeus was particularly popular in the medieval period, crucially because it was circulating in Latin translations. There were two versions circulating during the period, both from the 4th century, but the translation attributed to the 4th century Roman philosopher Chalcidius was generally favored. The medieval interest in the Timaeus is of note for us because within it Plato approaches women as a spiritual quandary. Here he presented his creation myth, which established the physical world as a moral proving ground, wherein men, who were considered to be the only humans, strove to achieve a higher state of being. Those who failed to do so were returned to Earth to live again. Yes, it is more or less an ancient Greek version of the Buddhist concept of reincarnation. But guess what? The men who were returned? They were punished for their inability to live a moral life by being sent back as women. Once women existed alongside men, the gods created sexual desire. Plato argued that sexual desire existed in a gendered manner. In men, the gods opened a special passage from the brain going along the spine that allowed semen to travel from the brain into the testicles. The semen itself had a soul and wanted to be released into uteruses in order to create new life. This desire was Eros. The thing about Eros was that it made men's penises act in an involuntary manner. Plato saw the penis as essentially out of control, a type of living, willful animal. This, in turn, mirrored his concept of the uterus. Much like the Hippocratic thinkers before him, Plato felt that the corresponding generative organ for women was an erratic creature. Climbing around inside the body and animated by a corresponding female sexual desire. Like Hippocrates, he argued that the uterus had to be pacified and pinned in place by pregnancy. Therefore, the unruly aspects of both penises and uteruses could be calmed through generative sexual activity. The fact that Plato accorded wildcard status to both penises and uteruses might seem like a kind of evolution or marker of progress over Hippocratic thought. It was not. While the unruly penis makes a brief appearance in his characterizations, the wandering uterus is a major figure, as well as the necessity of keeping it held in place by making babies. At the same time, there is a hierarchy to the way that Plato describes the generative desires of these organs. Semen wants to be released because it has a soul. Uteruses, meanwhile, desire to be given this material and its soul to make babies. Plato understood women as fallen men, and naturally inferior to men as a result. Correspondingly, he contended that society should organize itself in such a way that men would be able to control women. After all, women had already proven themselves incapable of making correct moral decisions. Otherwise, they wouldn't even be women. Philosophizing women's bodies. Aristotle. While Plato's Timaeus was immensely important in the Middle Ages, medieval thinkers lionized one philosopher above all others, and that was Aristotle, 384 to 322 BCE. Aristotle continues to be famous enough that he barely needs introduction even now. He is the other philosopher everyone knows. And once again, this was partly guaranteed by his presiding over his own school, where his ideas would find disciples and heirs. His was called the Lyceum, and it was also a temple dedicated to the god Apollo. Here, philosophers were trained in the Peripatetic school, named for the Lyceum's peripatoi, or walkways. The Peripatetics largely focused on preserving and commenting on Aristotle's works after his death, and they managed to keep the school running into the 3rd century AD. After that, Aristotle's works were picked up by the Romans, who were keen on demonstrating that they were the logical heirs to the Hellenistic world. To say that medieval intellectuals revered Aristotle would be an understatement. They were so enamored of Aristotle that they often referred to him simply.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?